afternoon and welcome to the LaRouche Show. It's Saturday, June 1st, 2013. I'm Harley Schlanger, and I will be your host. In a number of recent statements, Lyndon LaRouche has been emphasizing the absolute urgency of destroying the Queen of England. Not just the British monarchy or the British oligarchy, but specifically the Queen, who presides over an oligarchic faction which is openly committed to wiping out 6 billion people on the planet, by their own admission. And they're committed to doing this through war, through genocide, using war, civil war, regional war, and fascist austerity while they're defending the existing bankrupt system. Now, while it can be demonstrated, and we have on our website repeatedly demonstrated from their own acts and their own statements that this is their intention, there's an element of this warfare which is often overlooked. And that is it's either overlooked or I should say it may be unknown to most people, that there's a cultural component, that there's a role played by the oligarchy in destroying our culture. And when you ask yourself, why do we tolerate such figures as Barack Obama or George W. Bush? Obama, who's a pathological narcissist, Bush, who was an idiot, both of whom submitted themselves and their administrations, and ultimately the United States, to Tony Blair and the Queen. How is it that we elected Bush to a second term and just recently elected Obama to a second term? How is it that Obama, despite the fact that most people know he's a bum who's destroying the country, is still able to keep the media on his side, keep the Democratic Party under his control, and the Republican Party, for the most part, functions as an impotent anti-Obama chorus? This has a lot to do with the degeneration of culture, and in particular, the destruction of the method of classical musical composition. Today on the LaRouche Show, we're going to take a look at a crucial case study in this, in contrasting the classical humanist nationalism of Giuseppe Verdi with the oligarchical degeneracy of Richard Wagner. Now, both Wagner and Verdi were born 200 years ago. This is the 200th commemoration of their birth. Wagner was born May 22, 1813, a lamentable day in history. Verdi was born October 10, 1813. And both of them were involved politically. Wagner was on the barricades in Dresden. Wagner spent much of his life running away from his creditors, as he had a lavish lifestyle and couldn't make much money as a composer, at least in his early days. And so he was always running out of a town prior to the debt collector putting him in prison. Whereas Verdi attached himself, became a passionate fighter for republicanism in Italy, for the unification of the country, and his music played a leading role in encouraging that. Wagner's music, on the other hand, inspired Adolf Hitler, the Nazis, the genocidal faction, in part through Houston Stuart Chamberlain, who was a son-in-law of Wagner and a promoter of the race theories of the Nazis. So joining me on the program today to look at this contrast and to, I hope, get people to understand how it is that culture affects the way that you think is an old friend of mine, a classical musician, and an organizer with Lyndon LaRouche for many, many years, David Shaven. So, David, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much, Harley. It's great to have some time with you.
Well, we have been discussing some of these issues for many decades, and I think, as you said just a little while ago, we're in general agreement on this, but I think we should make the point from the very beginning that it's really not up to us to convince you that Wagner's music is terrible. Just listen to it, and you'll discover that. But what we want to give you is some insights into the mind of Wagner, and in contrast, again, into the mind of Verdi. So, David, when you take a look at Wagner and his work throughout his career, what's the first thing that jumps out at you?
Just deliberate ugliness. I mean, let's go through a case study of who Wagner is, because he gets at a very big psychological problem with the culture today that you and Mr. LaRouche brought up, that there are people who organize for genocide, and a lot of otherwise good people blink their eyes. They try to avoid what they're looking at. And it's the Wagner case. He was a non-entity for the first up to 1848. I guess he's 37 years old or so. He's been promoted by Meyerbeer because they both like grand spectacle. But he's never been that successful. Meyerbeer got one success for him. But otherwise, his career is stalled. He's not going anywhere. And he participates in the 1848 revolution, actually with a good friend of his, Bakunin.
The anarchist.
Yes. Which in Dresden, where he's living, actually takes place in the spring of 1849. I've never quite figured out exactly what he did. I think he was getting explosives.
Yeah, the rumors were that he was involved in a plot to do some bombings.
Yes. And the other people involved in this were put in jail for years and years. So Wagner was on the lam. The first place he runs to is Weimar, where Franz Liszt is living as the paramour of a countess, Sayn Wittgenstein. Mm-hmm. Who's a real, she portrays herself as a fervent Catholic, but she's a Satanist, a pagan, medievalist, blood and soil, you know. She's not the best part of the Catholic Church. And he runs, so Wagner runs to them, and we don't know all of exactly what happened in their at their castle, but they agree to sponsor him. He can be on the run, he get out of Germany. He goes to Paris and Switzerland, these places, for years. And they're sending him money.
Now, it should be noted that one of the things that Liszt and Wagner had in common was that in both cases, they had, especially in Wagner's case, an abhorrence for the classical musical tradition. There's a quote I couldn't find, but it's where Wagner said, well, you can have your Mozart operas, you can have your Songs Without Words, which is a reference to Mendelssohn. You can have your choral music in a symphony, which is a reference to Beethoven. But what we really need now is revolutionary art. And it was an attack on the classical tradition. And Liszt, of course, was someone who, like Wagner, had a huge ego and thought that what was important is the artist's interpretation, especially for the great show, the grand showmanship.
Absolutely. And all this is taking, this is a whole other story we won't have time for in this hour, but this is taking place because Schumann's been isolated at this point. Mendelssohn has died in 1847, in the fall of 1847, and their operations, which Liszt and Wagner wanted to push ahead before Mendelssohn's death, but they were not successful. They tried, but now they think they've got Schumann as the last representative, and they're going to drive him crazy.
And Schumann was not merely a representative, but he was a really passionate promoter of the Mozart-Beethoven method of composition.
Right. So Wagner, one of his major acts on his is this essay he writes, Das Judentum in der Musik, Jewishness in Music. It's published anonymously. He later says to Liszt the reason he published this essay anonymously was, again, the Jews, that he didn't want to take away from the real subject, and he put his name on it, they'd have somebody to attack. He's a very principled sort of guy. but let's just get at what he really says. And this is, for everybody's going to hear in this bicentennial year, that we can appreciate Wagner because, you know, his music is different from his political beliefs. By the end of this hour, we really should demolish that.
Well, in fact, what they say is that they're beginning to acknowledge that, well, maybe he had personality defects or maybe he wasn't a good person, but you have to separate the product from the artistic personality.
Exactly.
And I think what we have to show is that, in fact, the evil ugliness of his character comes through in the art that he thought he created.
Right. So he's out, his opening of several major points from his essay. Regarding Heine in Germany, he says, basically, only maggots attack dead flesh. Quote, so long as the separate art of music had a real organic life need in it, there was nowhere to be found a Jewish composer. Only when a body's inner death is manifest do outside elements win the power of lodgment in it, yet merely to destroy it. Then indeed that body's flesh dissolves into a swarming colony of insect life. But who in looking on that body's self would hold it still for living? So his attitude is, to put it his best, most charitable view, is there weren't Jewish composers back in the 18th century. We had Bach, and we can all bow down to Bach, even though he's, you know, as long as we put him in a cabinet, you know, put him away from any reality now. But sometime after Moses Mendelssohn came on the scene, the world's changed, meaning the American Revolution, the possibility that groups that had been kept in medieval life conditions, you know, this is what Wagner's world image is. And the problem with German music today, he's willing to admit, we have our problem. Our own music's not healthy because they're not celebrating me. and therefore, we're open to having these outside, you know, maggot elements feed off our own unhealthy, you know, operations. Next point.
This is still in this essay on essay. Jewishness and music. Yeah. Okay, go ahead.
If Jewish artists wish to help Germany, the Jewish solution is annihilation. Yeah, right. Quote, without once looking back, take ye your part in this regenerative work of deliverance through the bloody struggle of self-annihilation. Then we are one and undissevered. But bethink ye that only one thing can redeem you from your curse, that is the curse, the redemption of Osveros, going under. Now, he's not talking about converting Jews. Mendelssohn and Heine had both converted to Christianity. That doesn't solve his problem. And then, but I'm citing to get to the third and the last part I wanted to cite. His essay is much more an attack on Germans than Jews.
Mm-hmm. Well, and in fact, at that period of time, German culture and the Jewish population, because of the work of Moses Mendelssohn, were virtually undistinguishable.
Exactly. But his whole attack on Mendelssohn and Felix Mendelssohn,
yes,
which this is centered at, is the revolutionary developments of the collaboration between Mendelssohn and Schumann that was directly under attack. In fact, before I get to this last point, the journal that is willing to publish such a controversial article with an anonymous writer is this Brendel, the editor of the it's the old Schumann journal that was taken over. I forget the name of it.
Yeah, Schumann had a journal where he was writing essays and reviews promoting the classical tradition. And when he got sick, it was taken over and taken away from him, basically.
Yeah, Franz Brendel. It was the Neue Zeitschrift for music.
Yeah.
Franz Brendel, who was just a doctrinaire Hegelian, had written a pre-Wagner article 5 years before in 1845, very academic. And it's basically that Schumann's got a break from Mendelssohn because an outsider can never understand our music.
Mm-hmm.
But he has relatively nice Hegelian terms about, you know, why they cannot be, they're just fixed categories, and they're Jewish categories, and they're, but it's this, Schumann is best when he's wild and romantic, and there's too much of the rational about Mendelssohn. And our German nature doesn't really go with that. So Brendel's going to publish this follow-up now that Mendelssohn's dead. It's really quite unusual to publish such an article such a controversial article without the person being willing to. The editor takes on all the opprobrium, you know, when he's not identifying who's writing the article.
Yeah.
So anyhow, Wagner's last point on the Germans. He says later that his essay was written, quote, to explain to ourselves the involuntary repellence possessed for us by the nature and personality of the Jews, so as to vindicate that instinctive dislike which we plainly recognize as stronger and more overpowering than our conscious zeal to rid ourselves hereof. Now, that sentence, I find, I don't, you know, you can compare it to Prince Philip, you know, his fantasies about reducing the world's population down to, you know, by 6 million or so. There's very few sentences as ugly as this one on
well,
so many nothing, different levels.
There's nothing in that sentence with which the Nazis would disagree with
yeah, exactly.
in their policy of an attempted annihilation of the Jews. And I think the important point here is that because Wagner then later, what was it, 20 years later, republished this, and he signed it the second time.
Correct.
So there's no question that this is Wagner's view.
Right.
And this has the fact that this has now been published and is out in the open, and there's been a real historical examination of the character of Wagner. There's no mistake that he was a vile, ugly, nasty anti-Semite who didn't really like many people. He saw himself as a god among the population. His wife, his second wife, who was the illegitimate daughter of Franz Liszt, referred to him as the Meister, the master, and he tried to promote that kind of image. Now, the point of this is that it's just necessary to identify this to show that this was a character who, in his on his best day, was an evil representation of everything that's ugly in our culture. Now, David, how does this relate then to after 1848, when suddenly there's some money coming his way? A number of people, mostly rich merchants, funded a few of his works, and then King Ludwig of Bavaria became the patron of Wagner. What did he start doing that at that point absolutely cemented his? I guess you would say, his virtuosity in this area.
Well, let me cover one major point before we... I mean, he just explicitly picks up medievalist blood and soil romance, the Nibelungen epic, and it plays upon, you know, Ludwig and others, anybody who post-1848, similar to what happened in post-the Kennedy and the King assassinations in the United States. You have a lot of hurt people who are going to retreat into fantasy land, because reality, they don't want to solve the problems that reality is presenting them. But we can, let me...
Yeah, go ahead.
The point about, this on the point of, sure, he's an evil son of a bitch, but a lot of people say, well, there's something about his compositions which I can like without having to deal with that personality. This is his compositional method. He says about, when he says to explain to ourselves the involuntary repellence, there's something about us. He's just an empiricist. There's something about us. Let's be honest about that. And I'm writing this because we need to strengthen that part of us, that little peasant, I hate the outside world, you know, instinctive dislike, he calls it. We need to vindicate that instinctive dislike, which we plainly recognize. He wants to empower people to avoid any attempt to grow up, you know, to learn about other people, to learn about other parts of the world. You know, we are supposed to celebrate the conscious zeal, which he says is less powerful, is not as powerful as what he's going to present as we celebrate our innate proclivities. That conscious zeal is what made Germany, was the height of Germany, German culture. You know, between Goethe and Schiller and Moses Mendelssohn and Felix Mendelssohn, you know, the classical method that Wagner hated was exactly what he was willing to, that was foreign, you know, and
yeah.
So this is he gets right.
In his case, it's a submission to that little beast man
exactly
inside you that basically says, "Well, I can't control anything, but I can have my passions and my hatred and my irrational beliefs, and no one can challenge those.
Actually, the way I ended up that section of an article a couple of years ago was I said, Freethinker, the anonymous name of the author is in English, K. Freethinker.
Mm-hmm.
Freethinker advises, don't fight your inmost nativist inclinations. Let the beast out. It's Dr. Strangelove wrestling with his Nazi saluting right arm, but now allowed free rein.
Mm-hmm.
Which, you know, for a modern audience, Dr. Strangelove is not a bad image on what Wagner was and what he put his audiences through. Which is, I mean, that's your point on the whole Ring cycle. What we're talking about on the Ring cycle is just pure 15 hours of sitting in a specially contrived theater built by King Ludwig's money and others because all other theaters would not be appropriate to what Wagner had to have a unified effect, a grand spectacle.
Well, let me say something on that because First let me just identify. This is the LaRouche Show. It's Saturday, June 1st, 2013. And we're talking about how the oligarchic tradition is reinforced against the classical humanist tradition. And our guest today is David Shaven. David, one of the things that I would like to just emphasize on that is that you have this period of time where Wagner is being promoted and where the Ring cycle is being turned into the cult-like devotees of Wagner's work. Wagner had this idea of the total work of art, where he said explicitly that the music is subordinate to the drama, and it's the grand drama that they're trying to create at Bayreuth, where the home that Ludwig II built for Wagner. But this is occurring at a point where there's a global revolution going on. The American system is spreading in Europe. You might say that the work of Moses Mendelssohn, of Mozart, of Joseph II of Austria, Friedrich List, not Franz List, but Friedrich List, the great German economist, and then the ideas of Lincoln and Lincoln's advisors, the American system, mm-hmm. were being brought into Germany, brought into Italy, brought into France, Russia, China. You had a tremendous economic growth, which was oriented toward taking people out of being a slave to an oligarchy. And that's when Wagner was being promoted with this idea of celebrating the beast in an earlier golden age before you had these ideas of the innate dignity of man.
Exactly. I'm sort of reminded of what should have happened in our culture, in the United States, after World War II, in terms of all the efforts people put in to defeat fascism and a genocide policy, defeat the gang that Bush's granddaddy and their friends around the Queen, you know, put into power. But, you know, you'd think that, anyhow, what we ended up having is...
You were going to make a point on this medievalism and the importance of that in terms of what Wagner was deployed to do.
Yeah, but yeah, we had deliberate ugliness be foisted upon us by the CCF. You had classical music concerts where people would just be perplexed by some piece of garbage being put in with Beethoven. You know, so they confused. It didn't look like evil. Well, this Wagner period, it wasn't that people really couldn't argue about having a unified effect, you know, or they took out of Beethoven when Beethoven had a unified effect to emotive hearing, they would come up with this idée fixe of Berlioz and others. And, you know, so they would take these technical things that people thought they would, it wasn't obvious that it was undermining their own culture or their own way of thinking. And they would use it for just pure brainwashing. And we can't get away from the fact that the population was demoralized after the 1848 mess. And solutions were not being, for the most part, given to the European population at that time. And that's what makes a guy like Wagner possible to promote him at that time. So they just embraced pure medievalism. You can sort of sum up the ring, that 15 hours of the ring cycle, and just saying, if you want to develop the material world for the benefit of higher cultural levels, you're just a little dirty dwarf named Alberic.
Yeah.
And you stole some gold from the Rhine, where these pure maidens were down there guarding, you know, were there. And the whole thing goes on 15 hours until you come back and finally that, you know, the whole world's been burned up. But the gold's been returned to the Rhine and nature's still, you know, it's hard for me to understand exactly how the whole world gets burned up and the Rhine is still there. But there's a lot of parts of the opera that are hard to understand. So the basic sin is that human beings intervene upon material world for the improvement of nature. That's just sinful. That's the basic blood and soil medievalism. You can go into a lot of other details there.
Well, but it's also the defense of the gods of Olympus, who require that the world not change, not be changed by man, for them to maintain their dominance.
For sure. This might be even a step or two more evil than that. There's something about sort of a fixed world where you just have lords and peasants. There's something even, and I'm sure the medieval lords would use Wagner for this, but as far as what's inside Wagner's head on this sort of stuff, you know, there's a lot of God of Dameron. There's a lot of bring the whole world down.
Yeah.
You know, he's just a wild anarchist from 1848, you know, mm-hmm. who's willing to use his semi-talents for staging great spectacles for people who will find it useful to have the demoralization and the deliberate dumbing down and deculturalization of the population.
Now, before we get to Verdi, which is a different kettle of fish, besides the ring cycle, I just recently saw Tristan und Isolde, which is one of these operas which some people just say they love. They can't get enough of it. Mm. And the story is supposedly playing out, again, it's a medieval story, and it's an attempt to take the philosophy of Schopenhauer, and who Wagner at that time was somewhat infatuated with. And the two things about Schopenhauer is, one is you can't know anything about the way the universe runs, that it's your sense perception is limited, but that's all you know, so therefore you can't know everything. And secondly, there's a big gap between what you want and what you can get, and that's the tragedy. You know, it's almost like the Rolling Stones philosophy of the world. It's an inane philosophy.
Yeah.
And I sat there watching this opera unfold, where you basically have a guy and a woman who want to kill each other, and then they decide they're going to drink a death potion, and instead the woman's assistant gives them a love potion, and then they spend the whole second act basically having sex while they're screeching. And at the end of that, they keep saying, well, we can't do this in the light. We have to do it in the dark. And it's night and day, dark and light, love and death. Supposedly these powerful conceptions of mortality and immortality, but it's stupid. It's just inane. And then in the last act, he basically kills himself to show his love for her, and he expects her to come there before he dies to show her love for him so they can both be immortal. And then she sings for an hour and a half, or that's a little bit long, but 40 minutes of her love for him, and that's the end. And when this was being written, Wagner was engaging in an affair with a woman named Wessendonck, whose husband was funding him. And she wrote a series of poems that were about this philosophical view of night and day, not knowing everything, not needing to know things, just know that I love you. And what you have is Wagner essentially trying to pull people into the pit and exalting his ability to love, showing that because he could write this, this is true love, and this is his key to immortality. And, you know, it's it reminds me, when you talk about the Ring Cycle and Tristan and Isolde, it's very much like the Tolkien's Lord of the Rings or Harry Potter, where you create an alternate reality.
Mm-hmm.
But the key to it is the sense of the artist that they are the ones who have the keys to this great power of knowledge. But what is the knowledge? It's just they're what they want, what they wish.
Right. It's this gratuitous existentialism, this existentialist act, you know, that I don't want to do the work of figuring out what my mission in life is. I just want one big sensational act. You know, so love and death are the same. You know, it's...
childish and inane.
To put it in front of an audience, it's a deliberate choice to bring people into a satanic cult.
Now, the fact that it was funded by Ludwig II and was promoted in Germany at the time, just to make a point on this, Clara Schumann commented on Tristan und Isolde, and she said, it was the most disgusting thing I've ever been subjected to. And I think I'll leave it at that. But we'll come back to Wagner in a moment. I want to take up the contrary case of a person who, in the tradition of Mozart and Beethoven, makes his music a tool for uplifting a population to take on the tasks of the mission of life. And how do you see Verdi in this context? We were talking before the program about his political involvement as well as his musical work. What are your thoughts on Verdi's 200th birthday?
Well, it makes it a very good year, I guess. The just a small side comment, because which Wagner opera you just seen?
Tristan.
Yeah, the Tristan.
Yeah.
I think one of Verdi's friends commented when the opera was booed off the stage on its, I think it's, was it in Paris, 1859?
Yeah.
Just, you know, and his friend who saw it in Paris writes to Verdi, well, this one's over. I guess it just proves that, if you try to write, you put on stage something with no music to it at all, people won't buy into that. Verdi grew up in a country that was being kept in medieval circumstances. The Austrian Empire ran this. And in the early part of the 19th century, you'd have to be willfully stupid, you know, amoral and stupid to sort of not know what the condition was. And Verdi early on associated himself with the Nabucco opera. On taking, you know, the famous case of the Hebrew slaves in under Nebuchadnezzar, Nabucco,
mm-hmm.
You know, and even if they didn't have the power to immediately change their circumstance, they were not going to adopt a subhuman identity. And Verdi's voice kept Italy alive in the 1840s, 1850s, before they were able to become a republic.
I think it's worth noting, because I know you've done an enormous amount of work on this, that there had been a contrary tradition or attempt in the Austrian Empire, the Austro-Hungarian Empire, under Joseph II, to carry out American-type reforms. And it had been crushed. And by the time of Verdi's childhood, the Austrian Empire was an enforcer of the backwardness in Europe, which allowed the British Empire to essentially dominate the world.
No, absolutely. If that period in the 1780s, if the American Revolution had been successfully assimilated and adopted in Europe, and Joseph II was one of the leading proponents of that, the last several hundred years would have been different. It's unnatural to have had the American Revolution establish and put an idea on the table that nations can be much more powerful, capable, happier by developing their population's talents, by putting in the investment over 10, 30, 20, 30, 40 years, investments that don't get paid off for a long time into the future. And just think that way and think that's normal. For that idea to be put on the table and to be to have a group of medievalists decide to turn away from that, that story colors everything. So in 1831 or so, or 1832, there's a very vicious put-down of Italian Republicans. And the group that Verdi gathers around, I think it's Countess Maffei.
In Milan.
In Milan. These are a group of, there's all sorts of people who are against the Austrian Empire who are better and worse. Just like today, there's all sorts of people who are, you know, want to have Glass-Steagall. It's just common sense. But Maffei, I think, is having discussions with Verdi around that, going back to that period, after the American Revolution, bringing up Friedrich Schiller and what has to be, what level of culture and epistemology has to be revived to be able to break the power of these medievalists. And a good chunk of Verdi's operas are, you know, based upon his reading of, I just found this out before today's show, that even his Macbeth, which you take as Shakespeare, is Friedrich Schiller's German translation of the Macbeth. The 1845 Joan of Arc from Schiller.
Mm-hmm.
The 1847 I Masnadieri from Schiller's The Robbers.
Yeah.
1849 Luisa Miller, Cabala und Liebe.
Yeah.
Even La Forza del The Force of Destiny, not from Schiller, but I didn't know this. It includes scenes from Wallenstein.
Huh.
And then you have the very explicit Don Carlos. So, you know, it's not a side story what Verdi is thinking about as he's trying to fundamentally change revive the Renaissance thinking of the Italian population.
Well, actually, now that you mention that, there's an important element here of the nature of tragedy, the different approach to tragedy that Verdi had, which comes from Schiller, which is to create a work of art in which you see a horror occur on the stage because of the practices of the time, but it's done in such a way that the actual beauty, beautiful potential of man is there in the audience as a counter to that. Whereas in Wagner, you have this Schopenhauer view, which is that life is tragedy because you can't really get what you want.
Yes. Yes.
And therefore, you get as much as you can before you lose everything.
And that's
and
the difference.
I think this gets right to the point you were making about the American Revolution. The idea that you're doing art for the future as opposed to glorify something in the past.
Exactly. And people get a little bit uncomfortable when they watch their children and their grandchildren getting sucked into gratuitous violence in their video games and God knows whatever else is out there. This is not normal. There's always been, you know, struggles raising kids and getting over their hormones and whatever else. But there always was a classical method where people intervene on their culture, where they're saying that this singular power that makes us in the image of God makes us capable of beating any evil. And I'm not going to put on stage any gratuitous evil. What you're going to see there, which may get under your skin, may bother you, but it's going to be presented for the purpose of putting a task in front of you, of making you better than you ever thought you were going to be, of going beyond your destiny.
Well, and I think that's also where you get at the question of the musical composition, because Verdi was a great student of Mozart and Beethoven. He used to take walks carrying the miniature scores of the Mozart and Beethoven quartets. And if you look at especially the period through a so-called middle period through the end of his life, his experimentation with fugues and with duets and quartets and quintets and so on, whereas with Wagner you have nothing but endless singing which goes nowhere. And I think this is the difference
You exaggerate. You know, what we're calling singing there is
yes,
doo-wah, 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 doo-wah. You know,
well, it's almost deliberately designed to destroy the vocal cords of the singers. There was a famous story about what people considered the Tristan curse, because I believe it was the first two Tristans died shortly after their debut in the role.
Goodness.
So, but this is important because the whole idea of man, which comes through in Verdi, even where you see evil acts and where you see horrible things occur, there's a different conception of man that's available to the audience than Wagner, who wants the audience to dive into the pit and basically say, this is all you can get. Thank God we were lucky enough to have a Wagner.
Exactly. I mean, you hit it on the head with Verdi's connection with Schiller's view of theater. They know they can intervene and change the culture for the better, that people can walk out of that theater a changed person for the better. The theater has the power to do that. But it's not, you know, some simple Sunday impotent lecturing. It's actually saying the things that'll get you in trouble. Naming the evil, naming the things that have to be named, and doing it from the standpoint that you're equipping people, you're summoning up within people a quality that the satanic forces in the world don't believe they have. People, the Wagner approach is, I know you're a little bitty beast. You have little, 99% of your psychological life is dominated by little grudges you have and little hatreds you have. And I'll make you fall in love with what I do, and you will never even identify why it is. But when people go and examine one of these things, it's not different than what they're spending most of their time with today. I don't know what they're doing when they're watching, what do they have, a contest for, our culture is singing contest and entertainment contest, which is really beat down the other guy things.
Well, just, you know, to get to this point, the bridge to this, you brought something up earlier, the tradition today of symphony orchestras having a Beethoven piece maybe to draw the crowd and then presenting three or four modern pieces with it. Actually, I think this is where you begin to see the importance of what was done with Wagner, to say that all that went before has to be rejected, mm-hmm. as opposed to what Schumann said, which is that the great tradition is what gives us the potential to build something new. And with Schumann and his musical, his circle and also his magazine, the idea was to develop in a new generation of musicians like Josef Joachim and others an appreciation of what Bach represented, of how Mozart learned from Bach and Haydn. Whereas what Wagner said is, all of that is prologue. Now I'm here, I'm the new music. Mm-hmm. And what the new music represented was a radical rejection of that previous classical method.
Right. It actually just reminds me, there's a wonderful little psychologically devastating letter that Josef Joachim wrote regarding Liszt and on Schiller, regarding his approach to it. Let me see if I can find it real quickly. Here it is.
Joachim was the great violinist who was a very close friend of Brahms and also Clara Schumann. Worked with them for many years.
Student of Mendelssohn.
Yeah.
And lifelong close friend of Brahms in their fight against Liszt and Wagner.
Who Wagner tried to recruit at one point.
Liszt.
Actually, because he was supposed to be for the violin what Liszt had been for the piano.
Yeah, I mean, basically, that's Joachim is only like 16 years old when Mendelssohn dies. Mendelssohn dies at the age of 38. Joachim spent his years from 12 to 16 working with Mendelssohn. That's his world in Leipzig. And, you know, he was taken away from him, and he has disillusionment, and he wanders for several years, and he buys into the argument from Liszt in Weimar that they're going to revive Schiller and revive Goethe, and this is going to be the music of the future. And for a year or two, at the age of about 19 or 20 or 21, they bring Joachim in as the lead violinist. He breaks with them. And, well, we have to do two quotes now. The quote I was going to read is at a point he hasn't publicly broken with Liszt. He just walked away from left Weimar, and he's now met Brahms. And Brahms and Schumann and Joachim now have new hopes for reviving classical culture. And Joachim writes his letter regarding Schiller. He says, of Caroline Sayn Wittgenstein and the discussions he had with her and Liszt about Schiller. He says, quote, "I have nothing in common with her, least of all with her enthusiasm for my soul's favorite Schiller. The only thing about Schiller which would appeal to the princess's nature, as exhibited on its most bearable side in her chatter about the immortal Liszt, would be the superficial grandeur of his aspirations." Meaning Schiller, you know, so Schiller just put a big task in front of people, and so you get Liszt and Caroline Sayn von Wittgenstein, you know, rhapsodizing about this stuff. But he finishes the comment, "The magnitude of his ideas satisfies her lust of power, just as the pathos of Schiller's language suits her Polish sense of family pride and royal dignity." Don't take it as an attack on the Poles. Her nobility comes from the Polish aristocracy.
Yeah.
"Of the intrinsic worth of the great man Schiller, in whom the love of justice had grown to be the guiding destiny of life, of the majesty of mind which, in spite of all obstacles, still believed in the growing seed of truth, of Schiller's reverence for the individual arising from his love for the universal, of the Schiller whom I mean, the finicking princess has no notion."
Yeah.
So he's just working out what he'd been through. But then, you know, finally, since now there's got to be one other quote, just since we're in the personal testimony on it. Oh, after Schiller, Joachim and Clara Schumann and Johannes Brahms participate in some musical seminars with the scientist at Göttingen involving Dirichlet and Bernhard Riemann in 1855 and 1856. Mm-hmm. These guys realize, as young men, Joachim and Brahms realize as young men that the cultural world is sick. There's no Schumann's basically gone from the scene. Mendelssohn's gone. Are they to adjust to the new realities of the world? I go into this a little bit because what Mr. LaRouche is putting out. Just because everything in the world, every time you open up the morning newspaper, there's no discussion of Glass-Steagall, of anything but bailouts, how much you got to cut back on granny's access to medical care, et cetera, et cetera. It doesn't mean people have to brainwash themselves. So in this situation, as young men, Brahms and Joachim, we should not underrate the courage and what they had to work through to decide to make a fight for culture as two young men when they see nobody else willing to make the fight. Nobody else, you know. And they're like 25 years old. So finally, Joachim admits to Clara Schumann that her sensibilities about Liszt were always correct, that before Joachim had thought he was a very talented person, and that when he took all these great works from Schiller and Dante and literature and gave poetic renditions of it on the piano, that maybe he was a little bit in excess, but he had decent intentions in trying to, you know, present music as coherent with the best of literature, you know, but he finally found out this guy was a real whore, just whose relationship to great music was like a whore's relationship to making love.
Mm-hmm.
So he, again, let me kind of find this quote also. Here it is. He finally decides he has to write the list directly to clear the air. And he says, I find this one of the best letters I've ever read in my life. He tells Liszt, who nobody does this to Liszt. Quote, "Your music is entirely antagonistic to me. It contradicts everything with which the spirits of our great ones have nourished my mind from my earliest youth. If it were thinkable that I could ever be deprived of, that I should ever have to renounce all that I learnt to love and honor in their creations, all that I feel music to be, your strains would not fill one corner of the vast waste of nothingness. I must rather make up my mind to strive for that which I have marked out for myself, for that which I know to be good and which I consider to be my mission. I can be of no assistance to you." Liszt has written him saying, inviting him one more year. For 5 years in a row, he's been writing him, "Come back to Weimar, come, you know, be my violinist. I can be of no assistance to you, and I can no longer allow you to think that the aims for which you and your pupils are working are mine. Because List is still trying to invoke Goethe and Schiller because the Prince of Weimar is, comes from the Goethe and Schiller period. He says, I revere the memory of the prince who lived with Goethe and Schiller and wished to rest with them too much to be present out of mere curiosity. So it's just, you know, you can tell the focused state of mind, the Entschlossenheit that Joachim and Brahms have taken on as young men.
Well, I think here's the important point, because Brahms also had a healthy form of German nationalism. You get it from his German Requiem, for example. The interest they had in the work of Bismarck in unifying the nation and developing the economy. What you point out in the tradition in the 19th century, which really goes back to the Moses Mendelssohn tradition, of the relationship between music and science as a motor for the development of civilization, as opposed to this conceited egoistic sense of an enhancing sensuality as a means of gaining pleasure from music, which you have from Liszt and from Wagner. Now, I think because we're down to about the last 10 minutes, the important thing, what we're trying to get at here, is not just that there are two different conceptions of man and that find their expressions in musical composition, but that an oligarchy promoted deliberately the filthy tradition of Liszt and Wagner, beginning with the Bayreuth festivals. But this year, here we have the 200th anniversary of Wagner's birth, and you have many opera companies performing the Ring Cycle. You have promotion of the heroic image of Wagner. And this comes at a point where what mankind needs is clearly the shock of reality that this oligarchy that is trying to lull you on the one hand and drum in your head Wagner is out to kill you with Obamacare, with bailouts and bail-ins, with arming al-Qaeda and jihadist anti-human forces from this Anglo-Saudi operation.
Medievalism.
The same thing, exactly. Religious warfare. That the tradition that was present during the most barbarous times in the modern era is what is glorified by Wagner. And yet, for that to be appearing with some support today on the stage is just an example of the degeneracy that's crippling and destroying our culture.
Well, people can fight their way out of this. It works to the extent that people view their lives as, it's a complicated world. I don't understand it all. I'm going to get through it as best as I can. I won't kick the dog. I'll be nice to my neighbors as much as I can. And then they, you know, let me have my entertainment. Life it's going to go on for so long. This oligarchy understands this. When they were doing, after World War II in the United States, this Congress of Cultural Freedom operation, it wasn't that they had to celebrate, you know, just freakish pieces of music. They actually only would, even to this day, they rarely include more than one of these things with otherwise decent music. The point was, you could hate it. You could hate the music. But it was expected you would hate the music. The point was, though, everything's equal. Whatever you think you really loved about Mozart or Beethoven and hearing it, other people have other preferences.
Yeah.
And there's nothing about your love relationship with Mozart or Beethoven that should be taken for anything more than that.
Mm-hmm.
If there's
a personal choice.
When you were 15 and you know, from the pop radio about, you know, dealing with your hormones and your love interest, well, you're never going to get over that. That tune's going to be in your head for the rest of your life. You know, because you're not going to grow up beyond the age of 15. And to the extent we've been deprived of a mission as a country, which would require adults to take joy and pride in a bigger mission, the oligarchy can get away with pushing entertainment, and they don't care whether you push button A or push button B. You can go to the classical radio stations, and to the extent you, it's, they present you with a something confusing, something subconsciously confusing, which is you can be entertained by this, and that's just your entertainment. You want to celebrate Verdi this year? That's okay. You want to celebrate Wagner this year? You know, but the people should know the composite, the mind of Wagner. That you forget everything you think you know about his music. The guy did not think his music was the prime thing. He, partly to his credit as a young man, thought that theater was something powerful that could change people. You know, and he just never was able to get the skills to do it properly.
Well, he also many times would praise Beethoven and Mozart, and he did try to compose some early symphonies.
Yeah.
But he couldn't do it.
But he had a life-changing event in 48 and 48 and 49, and he harnessed his task to people who would employ him to do evil. So when he says about we nativist Germans who have this, you know, innate feeling we cannot suppress and nothing we've tried will really is as powerful as those innate feelings, you know, take it seriously what he's doing to you when you think you're just going through 15 hours of a wonderful Tolkien, or I guess the people don't even do Tolkien anymore, whatever the storyline is in the video games the kids are playing, you know, whatever the hero who's shooting it out, whatever the soldiers are being recruited on, what they think they're shooting at in Afghanistan on their little video games, or their drone operations, whatever fantasies are going on in their head, this is the same oligarchy, it's the same method. And if people, before they fall into rage about not being able to pay their mortgage, or when they get unemployed, making choices about who's going to get medical care in their family, they have it within their power not to submit like a little beast. You know, they if they want it, that's
well,
always.
And David, let me just throw in here very quickly, because the other part of the oligarchical approach is sense perception. Is pragmatism. It's to have the senses be the mediator to reality as opposed to creative intellect. And this is what the Wagner total artwork is all about. You're overwhelmed by this vision and or the sensuality of the love and death theme.
Mm-hmm.
And that thinking is alien. Thinking gets in the way. And that's the other side of this, that culture is supposed to be something that's easy for you, as opposed to the idea that culture is that which puts you in contact with the higher faculties of your own mind.
Sure, absolutely.
And that's what the Schiller idea of tragedy is, precisely that you are presented with a story you think you may know, as in the case of Don Carlos. But what you discover is that many things that you thought you knew, you didn't really know. And that it's the challenge of the sense perception and pragmatism, which actually enables you to overcome the direct march into tragedy. And that's what's required today. We're marching into a tragedy for all of human civilization unless there's a break. And that break will not come until people recognize the difference between a Verdi and a Wagner. We have a couple minutes, David. Any last thoughts?
Well, sure. I mean, two things. Verdi was made a member of worked with Cavour, the Italian nationalist, back in 1860, 1861, in forming the nation of Italy. Cavour organized Verdi to join the new parliament in the Chamber of Deputies. He was a deputy and a senator. Shortly afterwards, Cavour unfortunately died in June of 1861. Two quotes from that. His wife, Giuseppina, said, "Verdi wept as at the death of his mother. He knew intimately that extraordinary, fascinating, marvelous man, that statesman who had conserved a heart in the midst of diplomacy and politics." And this is, I find that an interesting quote, because we get a little sense of what their view was about the potential for leaders of nations to not get dragged down by all the, you know, practical choices.
And David, we're going to have to stop with that because we've run out of time. But clearly, before the 300th anniversary of these two figures, we're going to have to take this up some more. And I thank you for joining us today. I would encourage all our listeners to go to the Schiller Institute website, where there are a series of articles, including some by David, on the great questions of the relationship between culture and politics. And also, this is an implicit theme in the most recent writings of Lyndon LaRouche, who is always taking up this question. So until next week, thank you for joining us today on The LaRouche Show, and we'll be back next week at 3 p.m. Eastern Time. And David, thank you again.
Hardy, thank you.